but maybe my Maharaja tunic confused him. This city is going to be like Dubai in 5 years, isn't it? 5, I said contemptuously, in 2 years. Look at that yellow crane. It's a monster. It was a monster, sitting at the top of the pit, with huge metal jaws, alternately gorging and disgorging immense quantities of mud, like creatures that had to obey it. Men with troughs of mud on their heads walked in circles around the machine. They did not look much bigger than mice. Even in the winter night, the sweat had made their shirts stick to their glistening black bodies. It was freezing cold when I returned to the car. All the other drivers had left. Still no sign of my masters. I closed my eyes and tried to remember what I had had for dinner. A nice hot curry with juicy chunks of dark meat, big puddles of red oil in the gravy. Nice. They woke me up by banging on my window. I scrambled out and opened the doors for them. Both were loud and happy and reeked of some English liquor. Whatever it was, I hadn't yet tried it at the shop. I tell you, they were going at it like animals as I drove them out of Connaught Place. He was pushing his hand up and down her thigh, and she was giggling. I watched 1 second too long. He caught me in the mirror. I felt like a child that had been watching his parents through a slit in their bedroom door. My heart began to sweat. I half expected him to catch me by the collar and fling me to the ground and stamp me with his boots the way his father used to do to fishermen in Laxmangar. But this man, as I've told you, was different. He was capable of becoming someone better than his father. My eyes had touched his conscience. He nudged Pinky Madam and said, "We're not alone, you know." She became grumpy at once and turned her face to the side. 5 minutes passed in silence. Reeking of English liquor, she leaned towards me. "Give me the steering wheel." "No, Pinky, don't. You're drunk. Let him..." "What a fucking joke. Everyone in India drinks and drives, but you won't let me do it?" "Oh, I hate this." He slumped on his seat. "Balram, remember never to marry." "Is he stopping at the traffic signal?" "Balram, why are you stopping? Just drive." "It's a traffic signal, Pinky. Let him stop. Balram, obey the traffic rules. I command you." "I command you to drive, Balram. Drive." Completely confused by this time, I compromised. I took the car 5 feet in front of the white line and then came to a stop. "Did you see what he did?" Mr. Ashok said. "That was pretty clever." "Yes, Ashok. He's a fucking genius." The timer next to the red light said that there was still 30 seconds to go before the light changed to green. I was watching the timer when the giant Buddha materialized on my right. A beggar child had come up to the Honda City, holding up a beautiful plaster of Paris statue of the Buddha. Every night in Delhi, beggars are always selling something by the roadside, books or statues or strawberries in boxes. But for some reason, perhaps because my nerves were in such a bad state, I gazed at the Buddha longer than I should have. It was just a tilt of my head, just a thing that happened for half a second, but she caught me out. "Balram appreciates the statue," she said. Mr. Ashok chuckled. "Sure, he's a connoisseur of fine art." She cracked the egg open. She lowered the window and said, "Let's see it," to the beggar child. He, or she, you can never tell with beggar children, pushed the Buddha into the Honda. "Do you want to buy the sculpture, driver?" "No, madam, I'm sorry." "Balram Halwe, maker of sweets, driver of cars, connoisseur of sculpture." "I'm sorry, madam." The more I apologized, the more amused the two of them got. At last, putting an end to my agony, the light changed to green, and I drove away from the wretched Buddha as fast as I could. She reached over and squeezed my shoulder. "Balram, stop the car." I looked at Mr. Ashok's reflection. He said nothing. I stopped the car. "Balram, get out. We're leaving you to spend the night with your Buddha, the Maharaja and the Buddha, together for the night." She got into the driver's seat, started the car, and drove away, while Mr. Ashok, dead drunk, giggled and waved goodbye at me. If he hadn't been drunk, he never would have allowed her to treat me like this. I'm sure of that. People were always taking advantage of him. If it were just me and him in that car, nothing bad would ever have happened to either of us. There was a traffic island separating the two sides of the road, and trees had been planted in the island. I sat down under a tree. The road was dead. Then two cars went by, one behind the other, their headlights making a continuous ripple on the leaves, like you see on the branches of trees that grow by a lake. How many thousands of such beautiful things there must be to see in Delhi, if you were just free to go wherever you wanted and do whatever you wanted. A car was coming straight toward me, flashing its headlights on and off and sounding its horns. The Honda City had done a U-turn, an illegal U-turn, mind you, down the road, and was charging right at me as if to plow me over. Behind the wheel I saw Pinky Madam grinning and howling, while Mr. Ashok next to her was smiling. Did I see a wrinkle of worry for my fate on his forehead? Did I see his hand reach across and steady the steering wheel so that the car wouldn't hit me? I like to think so. The car stopped half a foot in front of me with a screech of burning rubber. I cringed. How my poor tires had suffered because of this woman. Pinky Madam opened the door and popped her grinning face out.
Thought I had really left you behind, Mr. Maharaja?
No, madam.
You're not angry, are you?
Not at all. And then I added, to make it more believable, employers are like mother and father. How can one be angry with them? I got into the back seat. They did another U-turn across the middle of the avenue, and then drove off at top speed, racing through one red light after the other. The two of them were shrieking and pinching each other and making giggling noises, and helpless to do anything, I was just watching the show from the back seat when the small black thing jumped into our path, and we hit it and knocked it over and rode the wheels of the car over it. From the way the wheels crunched it completely, and from how there was no noise when she stopped the car, not even a whimper or a barking, I knew at once what had happened to the thing we had hit. She was too drunk to brake at once. By the time she had, we had hurtled on another 200 or 300 yards, and then we came to a complete stop, in the middle of the road. She had kept her hands on the wheel. Her mouth was open. A dog? Mr. Ashok asked me. It was a dog, wasn't it? I nodded. The street lights were too dim, and the object, a large black lump, was too far behind us already to be seen clearly. There was no other car in sight, no other living human being in sight. As if in slow motion, her hands moved back from the wheel and covered her ears.
It wasn't a dog. It wasn't a...
Without a word between us, Mr. Ashok and I acted as a team. He grabbed her, put a hand on her mouth, and pulled her out of the driver's seat. I rushed out of the back. We slammed the doors together. I turned the ignition key and drove the car at full speed all the way back to Gurgaon. Halfway through, she quieted down. But then, as we got closer to the apartment block, she started up again. She said, "We have to go back."
"Don't be crazy, Pinky. Balram will get us back to the apartment block in a few minutes. It's all over." "We hit something, Ashoki," she spoke in the softest of voices. "We have to take that thing to the hospital."
"No." Her mouth opened again. She was going to scream again in a second. Before she could do that, Mr. Ashok gagged her with his palm. He reached for the box of facial tissues and stuffed the tissues into her mouth. While she tried to spit them out, he tore the scarf from around her neck, tied it tightly around her mouth, and shoved her face into his lap and held it down there. When we got to the apartment, he dragged her to the elevator with the scarf still around her mouth. I got a bucket and washed the car. I wiped it down thoroughly and scrubbed out every bit of blood and flesh. There was a bit of both around the wheels. When he came down, I was washing the tires for the fourth time. Well, I showed him a piece of bloodied green fabric that had got stuck to the wheel. "It's cheap stuff, sir, this green cloth," I said,
rubbing the rough material between my fingers. It's what they put on children. And do you think the child... He couldn't say the word. There was no sound at all, sir. No sound at all. And the body didn't move, even a bit. God, Balram, what will we do now? What will we... He slapped his hand to his thigh. What are these children doing, walking about Delhi at 1 in the morning with no one to look after them? When he had said this, his eyes lit up. Oh, she was one of those people. Who live under the flyovers and bridges, sir? That's my guess, too. In that case, will anyone miss her? I don't think so, sir. You know how those people in the darkness are. They have 8, 9, 10 children. Sometimes they don't know the names of their own children. Her parents, if they're even here in Delhi, if they even know where she is tonight, won't go to the police. He put a hand on my shoulder, the way he had been touching Pinky Madam's shoulder earlier in the night. Then he put a finger on his lips. I nodded. Of course, sir. Now, sleep well. It's been a difficult night for you and Pinky Madam. I removed the Maharaja tunic, and then I went to sleep. I was tired as hell, but on my lips there was the big, contented smile that comes to one who has done his duty by his master, even in the most difficult of moments. The next morning I wiped the seats of the car as usual. I wiped the stickers with the face of the goddess. I wiped the ogre. And then I lit up the incense stick and put it inside, so that the seats would smell nice and holy. I washed the wheels one more time, to make sure there was not a spot of blood I had missed in the night. Then I went back to my room and waited. In the evening, one of the other drivers brought a message that I was wanted in the lobby, without the car. The mongoose was waiting for me up there. I don't know how he got to Delhi this fast. He must have rented a car and driven all night. He gave me a big smile and patted me on the shoulder. We went up to the apartment in the elevator. He sat down on the table and said, "Sit, sit. Make yourself comfortable, Balram. You're part of the family." My heart filled up with pride. I crouched on the floor, happy as a dog, and waited for him to say it again. He smoked a cigarette. I had never before seen him do that. He looked at me with narrowed eyes.
"Now it's important that you stay here in Buckingham Towers B Block and not go anywhere else, not even to A Block, for a few days, and not say a word to anyone about what happened."
"Yes, sir." He looked at me for a while, smoking. Then he said again, "You're part of the family, Balram." "Yes, sir." "Now go downstairs to the servants' quarters and wait there." "Yes, sir." An hour passed, and then I got called upstairs again. This time there was a man in a black coat, sitting at the dinner table next to the mongoose. He was looking over a printed piece of paper and reading it silently with his lips, which were stained red with pan. Mr. Ashok was on the phone in his room. I heard his voice through the closed door. The door to Pinky Madam's room was closed too. The whole house had been handed over to the mongoose. "Sit down, Balram. Make yourself comfortable." "Yes, sir." I squatted and made myself uncomfortable again. "Would you like some pan, Balram?" the mongoose asked. "No, sir." He smiled. "Don't be shy, Balram. You chew pan, don't you?" He turned to the man in the black coat. "Give him something to chew, please." The man in the black coat reached into his pocket and held out a small green pan. I stuck my palm out. He dropped it into my palm without touching me. "Put it in your mouth, Balram. It's for you." "Yes, sir. It's very good. Chewy. Thank you. Let's go over all this slowly and clearly." "Okay," the man in the black suit said. The red juice almost dripped out of his mouth as he spoke. "All right. The judge has been taken care of. If your man does what he is to do, we'll have nothing to worry about." "My man will do what he is to do. No worries about that. He's part of the family. He's a good boy." "Good, good." The man in the black coat looked at me and held out a piece of paper. "Can you read, fellow?" "Yes, sir." I took the paper from his hand and read, to whomsoever it may concern. I, Balram Halway, son of Vikram Halway, of Laxmangar village in the district of Gaya, do make the following statement of my own free will and intention. That I drove the car that hit an unidentified person or persons, or person and objects, on the night of January 23rd this year, that I then panicked and refused to fulfill my obligations to the injured party or parties by taking them to the nearest hospital emergency ward. That there were no other occupants of the car at the time of the accident. That I was alone in the car, and alone responsible for all that happened. I swear by Almighty God that I make this statement under no duress and under instruction from no one. Signature or thumbprint. Balram Halway. Statement made in the presence of the following witnesses. Kusum Halway, of Laxmangar village, Gaya district. Chamandas Varma, advocate, Delhi High Court. Smiling affectionately at me, the mongoose said, "We've already told your family about it. Your granny. What's her name?"
Kusum.
I didn't hear that.
Kusum.
Yes, that's it. Kusum. I drove down to Laxmangar. It's a bad road, isn't it? And explained everything to her personally. She's quite a woman. He rubbed his forearms and made a big grin, so I knew he was telling the truth. She says she's so proud of you for doing this. She's agreed to be a witness to the confession as well. That's her thumbprint on the page, Balram, just below the spot where you're going to sign. If he's illiterate, he can press his thumb, the man in the black coat said, like this. He pressed his thumb against the air. He's literate. His grandmother told me he was the first in the family to read and write. She said you always were a smart boy, Balram. I looked at the paper, pretending to read it again, and it began to shake in my hands. What I am describing to you here is what happens to drivers in Delhi every day, sir. You don't believe me. You think I'm making all this up, Mr. Jabbar? When you're in Delhi, repeat the story I've told you to some good, solid, middle-class man of the city. Tell him you heard this wild, extravagant, impossible story from some driver about being framed for a murder his master committed on the road. And watch as your good, solid, middle-class friend's face blanches. Watch how he swallows hard, how he turns away to the window. Watch how he changes the topic at once. The jails of Delhi are full of drivers who are there behind bars, because they are taking the blame for their good, solid, middle-class masters. We have left the villages, but the masters still own us, body, soul, and ass. Yes, that's right. We all live in the world's greatest democracy. What a fucking joke. Doesn't the driver's family protest? Far from it. They would actually go about bragging. Their boy Balram had taken the fall, gone to Tihar jail for his employer. He was loyal as a dog. He was the perfect servant. The judges, wouldn't they see through this obviously forced confession? But they are in the racket too. They take their bribe. They ignore the discrepancies in the case. And life goes on. For everyone but the driver. That is all for tonight, Mr. Premier. It's not yet 3 a.m., but I've got to end here, sir. Even to think about this again makes me so angry. I might just go out and cut the throat of some rich man, right now.
The fifth night. Mr. Jabbal. Sir, when you get here, you'll be told we Indians invented everything from the internet to hard-boiled eggs to spaceships before the British stole it all from us. Nonsense. The greatest thing to come out of this country in the 10,000 years of its history is the rooster coop. Go to Old Delhi, behind the Jama Masjid, and look at the way they keep chickens there in the market. Hundreds of pale hens and brightly colored roosters, stuffed tightly into wire mesh cages, packed as tightly as worms in a belly, pecking each other and shitting on each other, jostling just for breathing space. The whole cage giving off a horrible stench, the stench of terrified, feathered flesh. On the wooden desk above this coop sits a grinning young butcher, showing off the flesh and organs of a recently chopped-up chicken still oleaginous with a coating of dark blood. The roosters in the coop smell the blood from above. They see the organs of their brothers lying around them. They know they're next, yet they do not rebel. They do not try to get out of the coop. The very same thing is done with human beings in this country. Watch the roads in the evenings in Delhi. Sooner or later you will see a man on a cycle rickshaw pedaling down the road with a giant bed or a table tied to the cart that is attached to his cycle. Every day, furniture is delivered to people's homes by this man, the delivery man. A bed costs 5,000 rupees, maybe 6,000. Add the chairs and a coffee table, and it's 10,000 or 15,000. A man comes on a cycle cart, bringing you this bed, table and chairs. A poor man, who may make 500 rupees a month. He unloads all this furniture for you, and you give him the money in cash. A fat wad of cash, the size of a brick. He puts it into his pocket, or into his shirt, or into his underwear, and cycles back to his boss and hands it over without touching a single rupee of it. A year's salary, 2 years' salary, in his hands, and he never takes a rupee of it. Every day on the roads of Delhi, some chauffeur is driving an empty car with a black suitcase sitting on the back seat. Inside that suitcase is 1,000,000, 2,000,000 rupees. More money than that chauffeur will see in his lifetime. If he took the money, he could go to America, Australia, anywhere and start a new life. He could go inside the 5-star hotels he has dreamed about all his life and only seen from the outside. He could take his family to Goa, to England. Yet he takes that black suitcase where his master wants. He puts it down where he is meant to and never touches a rupee. Why? Because Indians are the world's most honest people, like the Prime Minister's booklet will inform you? No. It's because 99.9% of us are caught in the rooster coop, just like those poor guys in the poultry market. The rooster coop doesn't always work with minuscule sums of money. Don't test your chauffeur with a rupee coin or two. He may well steal that much, but leave $1,000,000 in front of a servant and he won't touch a penny. Try it. Leave a black bag with $1,000,000 in a Mumbai taxi. The taxi driver will call the police and return the money by the day's end. I guarantee it. Whether the police will give it to you or not is another story, sir. Masters trust their servants with diamonds in this country. It's true. Every evening on the train out of Surat, where they run the world's biggest diamond cutting and polishing business, the servants of diamond merchants are carrying suitcases full of cut diamonds that they have to give to someone in Mumbai. Why doesn't that servant take the suitcase full of diamonds? He's no Gandhi. He's human. He's you and me. But he's in the rooster coop. The trustworthiness of servants is the basis of the entire Indian economy. The great Indian rooster coop. Do you have something like it in China too? I doubt it, Mr. Jabhav. Or you wouldn't need the Communist Party to shoot people, and the secret police to raid their houses at night and put them in jail like I've heard you have over there. Here in India we have no dictatorship, no secret police. That's because we have the coop. Never before in human history have so few owed so much to so many, Mr. Jabhav. A handful of men in this country have trained the remaining 99.9%, as strong, as talented, as intelligent in every way, to exist in perpetual servitude. A servitude so strong that you can put the key of his emancipation in a man's hands, and he will throw it back at you with a curse. You will have to come here and see it for yourself to believe it. Every day, millions wake up at dawn, stand in dirty, crowded buses, get off at their master's posh houses, and then clean the floors, wash the dishes, weed the garden, feed their children, press their feet, all for a pittance. I will never envy the rich of America or England, Mr. Jabhav. They have no servants there. They cannot even begin to understand what a good life is. Now, a thinking man like you, Mr. Premier, must ask 2 questions. Why does the rooster coop work? How does it trap so many millions of men and women so effectively? Secondly, can a man break out of the coop? What if one day, for instance, a driver took his employer's money and ran? What would his life be like? I will answer both for you, sir. The answer to the first question is that the pride and glory of our nation, the repository of all our love and sacrifice, the subject of no doubt considerable space in the pamphlet that the Prime Minister will hand over to you, the Indian family, is the reason we are trapped and tied to the coop. The answer to the second question is that only a man who is prepared to see his family destroyed, hunted, beaten, and burned alive by the masters can break out of the coop. That would take no normal human being, but a freak, a pervert of nature. It would, in fact, take a white tiger. You are listening to the story of a social entrepreneur, sir.
To go back to my story, there is a sign in the National Zoo in New Delhi, near the cage with the white tiger, which says, "Imagine yourself in the cage." When I saw that sign, I thought, I can do that. I can do that with no trouble at all. For a whole day I was down there in my dingy room, my legs pulled up to my chest, sitting inside that mosquito net, too frightened to leave the room. No one asked me to drive the car. No one came down to see me. My life had been written away. I was to go to jail for a killing I had not done. I was in terror, and yet not once did the thought of running away cross my mind. Not once did the thought, "I'll tell the judge the truth," cross my mind. I was trapped in the rooster coop. What would jail be like? That was all I could think about. What kind of strategies would I follow to escape the big, hairy, dirty men I would find in there? I remembered a story from Murder Weekly, in which a man sent to jail pretended to have AIDS so that no one would bugger him. Where was that copy of the magazine? If only I had it with me now, I could copy his exact words, his exact gestures. But if I said I had AIDS, would they assume I was a professional bugger, and bugger me even more? I was trapped. Through the perforations of my net, I sat staring at the impressions of the anonymous hand that had applied the white plaster to the walls of the room. "Country Mouse!" Vitiligo lips had come to the threshold of my room. "Your boss is ringing the bell like crazy." I put my head on the pillow. He came into the room and pressed his black face and pink lips against the net. "Country Mouse, are you ill? Is it typhoid? Cholera? Dengue?" I shook my head. "I'm fine."
"Good to hear that."
With a big smile of his diseased lips, he left. I went up, like a man to his hanging, up the stairs and into the apartment building, and then up the elevator to the 13th floor. The mongoose opened the door. There was no smile on his face this time, not a hint of what he had planned for me. "You took your time coming. Father is here. He wants to have a word with you." My heart raced. The stork was here. He would save me. He wasn't useless, like his two sons. He was an old-fashioned master. He knew he had to protect his servants. He was on the sofa, with his pale legs stretched out. As soon as he saw me, his face broke open in a big smile, and I thought, he's smiling because he saved me. But the old landlord wasn't thinking of me at all. Oh, no. He was thinking of things far more important than my life. He pointed to those two important things. "Ah, Balram, my feet really need a good massage. It was a long trip by train." My hand shook as it turned on the hot water faucet in the bathroom. The water hit the bottom of the bucket and splashed all over my legs, and when I looked down, I saw that they were almost rattling. A trickle of urine was running down them. A minute later, a big smile on my face, I came to where the stork was sitting and placed the bucket of hot water near him. "Put your feet in, sir." "Oh," he said, and closed his eyes. His lips parted, and he began to make little moans, sir, and the sound of those moans drove me to press his feet harder and harder. My body began rocking as I did so, and my head knocked the sides of his knees. The mongoose and Mr. Ashok were sitting in front of a TV screen, playing a computer game together. The door to the bedroom opened, and Pinky Madam came out. She had no makeup on, and her face was a mess. Black skin under her eyes, lines on her forehead. The moment she saw me, she got excited.
"Have you people told the driver?"
The stork said nothing. Mr. Ashok and the mongoose kept playing the game.
"Has no one told him? What a fucking joke! He's the one who was going to go to jail?"
Mr. Ashok said, "I suppose we should tell him." He looked at his brother, who kept his eyes on the TV screen. The mongoose said, "Fine." Mr. Ashok turned to me. "We have a contact in the police. He's told us that no one has reported seeing the accident, so your help won't be needed, Balram." I felt such tremendous relief that I moved my hand abruptly, and the bucket of warm water spilled over, and then I scrambled to put the bucket upright. The stork opened his eyes, smacked me on the head with his hand, and then closed his eyes. Pinky Madam watched. Her face changed. She ran into her room and slammed the door.
"Who would have thought, Mr. Jabbaw, that of this whole family, the lady with the short skirt would be the one with a conscience?"
The stork watched her go into her room and said, "She's gone crazy, that woman, wanting to find the family of the child and give them compensation. Craziness! As if we were all murderers here!" He looked sternly at Mr. Ashok. "You need to control that wife of yours better, son. The way we do it in the village."
Then he gave me a light tap on the head and said, "The water's gone cold." I massaged his feet every morning for the next 3 days. One morning he had a little pain in his stomach, so the mongoose made me drive him down to Max, which is one of Delhi's most famous private hospitals. I stood outside and watched as the mongoose and the old man went inside the beautiful big glass building. Doctors walked in and out with long white coats and stethoscopes in their pockets. When I peeped in from outside, the hospital's lobby looked as clean as the inside of a 5-star hotel. The day after the hospital trip, I drove the stork and the mongoose down to the railway station, bought them the snacks they would need for their trip home, waited for the train to leave, and then drove the car back, wiped it down, went to a nearby Hanuman temple to say a prayer of thanks, came back to my room and fell inside the mosquito net, dead tired. When I woke up, someone was standing in my room, turning the lights on and off. It was Pinky Madam.
"Get ready. You're going to drive me."
"Yes, madam," I said, rubbing my eyes.
"What time is it?"
She put a finger to her lips. I put on a shirt, and then got the car out, and drove it to the front of the building. She had a bag in her hand.
"Where to?"
I asked. It was 2 in the morning. She told me, and I asked, "Isn't Sir coming?"
"Just drive."
I drove her to the airport. I asked no questions. When she got out at the airport, she pushed a brown envelope into my window, then slammed her door and left. And that was how, Your Excellency, my employer's marriage came to an end. Other drivers have techniques to prolong the marriages of their masters. One of them told me that whenever the fighting got worse, he drove fast so they would get home quickly. Whenever they got romantic, he let the car slow down. If they were shouting at each other, he asked them for directions. If they were kissing, he turned the music up. I feel some part of the responsibility falls on me that their marriage broke up while I was the driver. The following morning, Mr. Ashok called me to the apartment. When I knocked on the door, he caught me by the collar of my shirt and pulled me inside.
"Why didn't you tell me?" he said, tightening his hold on the collar, almost choking me. "Why didn't you wake me up at once?"
"Sir," she said...
He grabbed me and pushed me against the balcony of the apartment. The landlord inside him wasn't dead after all.
"Why did you drive her there, sister fucker?"
I turned my head. Behind me, I saw all the shiny towers and shopping malls of Gurgaon.
"Did you want to ruin my family's reputation?"
He pushed me harder against the balcony. My head and chest were over the edge now, and if he pushed me even a bit more, I was in real danger of flying over. I gathered my legs and kicked him in the chest.
He staggered back and hit the sliding glass door between the house and the balcony. I slid down against the edge of the balcony. He sat down against the glass door. The two of us were panting.
"You can't blame me, sir,"
I shouted. "I'd never heard of a woman's leaving her husband for good. I mean, yes, on TV, but not in real life. I just did what she told me to." A crow sat down on the balcony and cawed. Both of us turned and stared at it. Then his madness was over. He covered his face in his hands and began to sob. I ran down to my room. I got into the mosquito net and sat on the bed. I counted to 10 to make sure he hadn't followed me. Then, reaching under the bed, I took out the brown envelope and opened it again. It was full of 100 rupee notes. 47 of them. I shoved the envelope under the bed. Someone was coming toward my room. 4 of the drivers walked in.
"Tell us about it, Country Mouse."
They took positions around me.
"Tell you what?" "The gatekeeper spilled the beans. There are no secrets around here. You drove the woman somewhere at night and came back alone."
"Has she left him?"
"I don't know what you're talking about."
"We know they've been fighting, Country Mouse, and you drove her somewhere at night."
"The airport?"
"She's gone, isn't she? It's a divorce. Every rich man these days is divorcing his wife. These rich people."
He shook his head, his lips curled up in scorn, exposing his reddish, rotting, pan-decayed canines. "No respect for God, for marriage, family, nothing.
She just went out for some fresh air,
and I brought her back. That gatekeeper has gone blind."
"Loyal to the last.
They don't make servants like you anymore."
I waited all morning for the bell to ring, but it did not. In the afternoon, I went up to the 13th floor and rang the bell and waited. He opened his door and his eyes were red.
"What is it?"
"Nothing, sir. I came to make lunch."
"No need for that.
I thought he was going to apologize for almost killing me, but he said nothing about it."
"Sir, you must eat. It's not good for your health to starve."
"Please, sir." With a sigh, he let me in. Now that she was gone, I knew that it was my duty to be like a wife to him. I had to make sure he ate well and slept well and did not get thin. I made lunch, I served him, I cleaned up. Then I went down and waited for the bell. At 8 o'clock, I took the elevator up again. Pressing my ear against the door, I listened. Nothing, not a sound. I rang the bell. No response. I knew he couldn't be out. I was his driver, after all. Where could he go without me? The door was open. I walked in. He lay beneath the framed photo of the 2 Pomeranians, a bottle on the mahogany table in front of him, his eyes closed. I sniffed the bottle. Whiskey. Almost all of it gone. I put it to my lips and emptied the dregs. "Sir," I said, but he did not wake up. I gave him a push. I slapped him on the face. He licked his lips, sucked his teeth. He was waking up, but I slapped him a second time anyway. A time-honored servant's tradition, slapping the master when he's asleep, like jumping on pillows when masters are not around, or urinating into their plants, or beating or kicking their pet dogs, innocent servant's pleasures. I dragged him into his bedroom, pulled the blanket over him, turned the lights off and went down. There was going to be no driving tonight, so I headed off to the Action English liquor shop. My nose was still full of Mr. Ashok's whiskey. The same thing happened the next night, too. The third night he was drunk, but awake.
"Drive me," he said, "anywhere you want. To the malls, to the hotels, anywhere."
Around and around the shiny malls and hotels of Gurgaon I drove him, and he sat slouched in the back seat, not even talking on the phone for once. When the master's life is in chaos, so is the servant's. I thought, maybe he's sick of Delhi now. Will he go back to Dhanbad? What happens to me then? My belly churned. I thought I would crap right there on my seat, on the gearbox.
"Stop the car," he said.
He opened the door of the car, put his hand on his stomach, bent down and threw up on the ground. I wiped his mouth with my hand and helped him sit by the side of the road. The traffic roared past us. I patted his back. "You're drinking too much, sir."
"Why do men drink, Balram?"
"I don't know, sir."
"Of course, in your caste you don't. Let me tell you, Balram, men drink because they are sick of life. I thought caste and religion didn't matter any longer in today's world. My father said, 'No, don't marry her. She's of another—' I—"
Mr. Ashok turned his head to the side, and I rubbed his back, thinking he might throw up again, but the spasm passed. "Sometimes I wonder, Balram. I wonder what's the point of living. I really wonder." "The point of living?" My heart pounded. "The point of your living is that if you die, who's going to pay me 3,500 rupees a month?"
"You must believe in God, sir. You must go on. My granny says that if you believe in God, then good things will happen."
"That's true. It's true. We must believe," he sobbed.
"Once there was a man who stopped believing in God, and you know what happened?"
"What?"
"His buffalo died at once."
"I see," he laughed. "I see. Yes, sir, it really happened. The next day he said, 'God, I'm sorry, I believe in you,' and guess what happened?"
"His buffalo came back to life?"
"Exactly." He laughed again. I told him another story, and this made him laugh some more. "Has there ever been a master-servant relationship like this one? He was so powerless, so lost, my heart just had to melt. Whatever anger I had against him for trying to pin Pinky Madam's hit-and-run killing on me passed away that evening. That was her fault. Mr. Ashok had nothing to do with it. I forgave him entirely. I talked to him about the wisdom of my village, half repeating things I remembered Granny saying, and half making things up on the spot, and he nodded. It was a scene to put you in mind of that passage in the Bhagavad Gita when our Lord Krishna, another of history's famous chauffeurs, stops the chariot he is driving and gives his passenger some excellent advice on life and death. Like Krishna, I philosophized, I joked, I even sang a song, all to make Mr. Ashok feel better. Baby, I thought, rubbing his back as he heaved and threw up one more time, you big pathetic baby. I put my hand out and wiped the vomit from his lips, and cooed soothing words to him. It squeezed my heart to see him suffer like this. But where my genuine concern for him ended, and where my self-interest began, I could not tell. No servant can ever tell what the motives of his heart are. Do we loathe our masters behind a facade of love, or do we love them behind a facade of loathing? We are made mysteries to ourselves by the rooster coop we are locked in. The next day I went to a roadside temple in Gurgaon. I put a rupee before the two resident pairs of divine asses, and prayed that Pinky Madam and Mr. Ashok should be reunited and given a long and happy life together in Delhi. A week passed like this, and then the mongoose turned up from Dhanbad, and Mr. Ashok and I went together to the station to collect him. The moment he arrived, everything changed for me. The intimacy was over between me and Mr. Ashok. Once again I was only the driver. Once again I was only the eavesdropper. I spoke to her last night. She's not coming back to India. Her parents are happy with her decision. This can end only one way.
Don't worry about it, Ashok. It's okay. And don't call her again. I'll handle it from Dhanbad. If she makes any noise about wanting your money, I'll just gently bring up that matter of the hit and run. See? It's not the money I'm worried about, Mukesh.
I know. I know. The mongoose put his hand on Mr. Ashok's shoulder, just the way Kishan had put his hand on my shoulders so many times. We were driving past a slum, one of the series of makeshift tents, where the workers at some construction site were living. The mongoose was saying something, but Mr. Ashok wasn't paying attention. He was looking out the window. My eyes obeyed his eyes. I saw the silhouettes of the slum dwellers close to one another inside the tents. You could make out one family, a husband, a wife, a child, all huddled around a stove inside one tent, lit up by a golden lamp. The intimacy seemed so complete, so crushingly complete. I understood what Mr. Ashok was going through. He lifted his hand. I prepared for his touch, but he wrapped it around the mongoose's shoulder. When I was in America, I thought family was a burden. I don't deny it. When you and father tried to stop me from marrying Pinky because she wasn't a Hindu, I was furious with you. I don't deny it. But without a family, a man is nothing. Absolutely nothing. I had nothing but the driver in front of me for 5 nights. Now at last I have someone real by my side. You. I went up to the apartment with them. The Mongols wanted me to make a meal for them. And I made a dal and chapatis and a dish of okra. I served them and then I cleaned the utensils and plates. During dinner, the Mongols said, "If you're getting depressed, Ashok, why don't you try yoga and meditation? There's a yoga master on TV and he's very good. This is what he does every morning on his program." He closed his eyes, breathed in, and then exhaled slowly, saying, "Om." When I came out of the kitchen, wiping my hands on the sides of my pants, the mongoose said, "Wait." He took a piece of paper from his pocket and dangled it with a big grin, as if it were a prize for me. "You have a letter from your granny. What is her name?" He began to cut the letter open with a thick black finger. "Kusum, sir." "Remarkable woman," he said, and rubbed his forearms up and down. I said, "Sir, don't bother yourself. I can read." He cut the letter open. He began reading it aloud. Mr. Ashok spoke in English, and I guessed what he said. "Doesn't he have the right to read his own letters?" And his brother replied in English, and again I guessed, rather than understood, his meaning. "He won't mind a thing like this. He has no sense of privacy. In the villages there are no separate rooms, so they just lie together at night and fuck like that. Trust me, he doesn't mind." He turned so that the light was behind him and began to read aloud. "Dear grandson, this is being written by Mr. Krishna, the school teacher. He remembers you fondly and refers to you by your old nickname, the White Tiger. Life has become hard here. The rains have failed. Can you ask your employer for some money for your family? And remember to send the money home." The mongoose put the letter down. "That's all these servants want. Money, money, money. They're called your servants, but they suck the lifeblood out of you, don't they?" He continued reading the letter. "With your brother Kishan, I said, now is the time. And he did it. He married. With you, I do not order. You are different from all the others. You are deep, like your mother. Even as a boy, you were so. When you would stop near the pond and stare at the black fort with your mouth open in the morning and evening and night. So I do not order you to marry, but I tempt you with the joys of married life. It is good for the community. Every time there is a marriage, there is more rain in the village. The water buffalo will get fatter. It will give more milk. These are known facts. We are all so proud of you, being in the city. But you must stop thinking only about yourself and think about us too. First, you must visit us and eat my chicken curry. Your loving granny Kusum." The mongoose was about to give me the letter, but Mr. Ashok took it from him and read it again. "Sometimes they express themselves so movingly, these villagers," he said, before flinging the letter on the table for me to pick up. In the morning I drove the mongoose to the railway station and got him his favorite snack, the dosa, once again, from which I removed the potatoes, flinging them on the tracks before handing it over to him. I got down onto the platform and waited. He chomped on the dosa in his seat. Down below on the tracks, a mouse nibbled on the discarded potatoes. I drove back to the apartment block. I took the elevator to the 13th floor. The door was open. "Sir!" I shouted when I saw what was going on in the living room. "Sir, this is madness!" He had put his feet in a plastic bucket and was massaging them himself. "You should have told me. I would have massaged you," I shouted, and reached down to his feet. He shrieked, "No!" I said, "Yes, sir, you must. I'm failing in my duty if I let you do it yourself," and forced my hands into the dirty water in the bucket
and squeezed his feet.
No!
Mr. Asher kicked the bucket, and the water spilled all over the floor.
How stupid can you people get?
He pointed to the door. Get out.
Can you leave me alone for just 5 minutes in a day? Do you think you can manage that?
That evening I had to drive him to the mall again. I stayed inside the car after he got out. I did not mix with any of the other drivers. Even at night, the construction work goes on in Gurgaon. Big lights shine down from towers and dust rises from pits. Scaffolding is being erected, and men and animals, both shaken from their sleep and bleary and insomniac, go around and around carrying concrete, rubble or bricks. A man from one of these construction sites was leading an ass. It wore a bright red saddle, and on this saddle were two metal troughs, filled to the brim with rubble. Behind this ass, two smaller ones, of the same color, were also saddled with metal troughs full of rubble. These smaller asses were walking slower, and the lead ass stopped often and turned to them, in a way that made you think it was their mother. At once, I knew what was troubling me. I did not want to obey Kusum. She was blackmailing me. I understood why she had sent that letter through the mongoose. If I refused, she would blow the whistle on me, tell Mr. Ashok I hadn't been sending money home. Now, it had been a long time since I had dipped my beak into anything, sir, and the pressure had built up. The girl would be so young, 17 or 18, and you know what girls taste like at that age, like watermelons. Any diseases of body or mind get cured when you penetrate a virgin. These are known facts. And then there was the dowry that Kusum would screw out of the girl's family. All that 24-carat gold, all that cash fresh from the bank. At least some of it I'd keep for myself. All these were sound arguments in favor of marriage. But on the other hand... See, I was like that ass now. And all I would do, if I had children, was teach them to be asses like me and carry rubble around for the rich. I put my hands on the steering wheel, and my fingers tightened into a strangling grip. The way I had rushed to press Mr. Ashok's feet the moment I saw them, even though he hadn't asked me to. Why did I feel that I had to go close to his feet, touch them and press them and make them feel good? Why? Because the desire to be a servant had been bred into me, hammered into my skull nail after nail, and poured into my blood, the way sewage and industrial poison are poured into Mother Ganja. I had a vision of a pale, stiff foot pushing through a fire. No, I said. I pulled my feet up onto the seat, got into the lotus position, and said, Om, over and over again. How long I sat that evening in the car with my eyes closed and legs crossed like the Buddha, I don't know. But the giggling and scratching noise made me open my eyes. All the other drivers had gathered around me. One of them was scratching the glass with his fingernails. Someone had seen me in the lotus position inside the locked car. They were gaping at me as if I was something in a zoo. I scrambled out of the lotus position at once. I put a big grin on my face. I got out of the car to a volley of thumps and blows and shrieks of laughter, all of which I meekly accepted, while murmuring, Just trying it out. Yoga. They show it on TV all the time, don't they? The rooster coop was doing its work. Servants have to keep other servants from becoming innovators, experimenters, or entrepreneurs. Yes, that's the sad truth, Mr. Premier. The coop is guarded from the inside. Mr. Premier, you must excuse me. The phone is ringing. I'll be back in a minute. Alas, I'll have to stop this story for a while. It's only 1:32 in the morning, but we'll have to break off here. Something has come up, sir. An emergency. I'll be back. Trust me. The sixth morning. Pardon me, Your Excellency, for the long intermission. It's now 6:20, so I've been gone 5 hours. Unfortunately, there was an incident that threatened to jeopardize the reputation of an outsourcing company I work with. A fairly serious incident, sir. A man has lost his life in this incident. No, don't misunderstand. I had nothing to do with his death, but I'll explain later. Now excuse me a minute while I turn the fan on. I'm still sweating, sir, and let me sit down on the floor and watch the fan chop up the light of the chandelier. The rest of today's narrative will deal mainly with the sorrowful tale of how I was corrupted from a sweet, innocent village fool into a citified fellow full of debauchery, depravity, and wickedness. All these changes happened in me because they happened first in Mr. Ashok. He returned from America, an innocent man, but life in Delhi corrupted him, and once the master of the Honda City becomes corrupted, how can the driver stay innocent? Now, I thought I knew Mr. Ashok, sir, but that's presumption on the part of any servant. The moment his brother left, he changed. He began wearing a black shirt with the top button open, and changed his perfume. To the mall, sir? Yes. Which mall, sir? The one where Madame used to go. But Mr. Ashok would not take the bait. He was punching the buttons of his cell phone, and he just grunted, "Sahara Mall, Balram." That's the one Madame liked going to, sir. Don't keep talking about Madame in every other sentence. I sat outside the mall and wondered what he was doing there. There was a flashing red light on the top floor, and I guessed that it was a disco. Lines of young men and women were standing outside the mall, waiting to go up to that red light. I trembled with fear to see what these city girls were wearing. Mr. Ashok didn't stay long in there, and he came out alone. I breathed out in relief. Back to Buckingham, sir. Not yet. Take me to the Sheraton Hotel. As I drove into the city, I noticed that something was different about the way Delhi looked that night. Had I never before seen how many painted women stood at the sides of the roads? Had I never seen how many men had stopped their cars in the middle of traffic to negotiate a price with these women? I closed my eyes. I shook my head. What's happening to you tonight? At this point, something took place that cleared my confusion, but also proved very embarrassing to me and to Mr. Ashok. I had stopped the car at a traffic signal. A girl began crossing the road in a tight T-shirt, her chest bobbing up and down like 3 kilograms of brinjals in a bag. I glanced at the rearview mirror, and there was Mr. Ashok, his eyes also bobbing up and down. I thought, "Aha, got you, you rascal." And his eyes shone, for he had seen my eyes, and he was thinking the exact same thing. "Aha, got you, you rascal." We had caught each other out. This little rectangular mirror inside the car, Mr. Jabbao, has no one ever noticed before how embarrassing it is, how every now and then, when master and driver find each other's eyes in this mirror, it swings open like a door into a changing room, and the two of them have suddenly caught each other naked. I was blushing. Mercifully, the light turned green and I drove on. I swore not to look in the rearview mirror again that night. Now I understood why the city looked so different, why my beak was getting stiff as I was driving. Because he was horny, and inside that sealed car, master and driver had somehow become one body that night. It was with great relief that I drove the Honda into the gate of the Maurya Sheraton Hotel and brought that excruciating trip to an end. Now, Delhi is full of grand hotels. In ring roads and sewage plants, you might have an edge in Beijing, but in pomp and splendor, we're second to none in Delhi. We've got the Sheraton, the Imperial, the Taj Palace, Taj Mansingh, the Oberoi, the Intercontinental, and many more. Now, the 5-star hotels of Bangalore I know inside out, having spent thousands of rupees eating kebabs of chicken, mutton, and beef in their restaurants, and picking up sluts of all nationalities in their bars. But the 5 stars of Delhi are things of mystery to me. I've been to them all, but I've never stepped past the front door of one. We're not allowed to do that. There's usually a fat guard at the glass door up at the front, a man with a waxed mustache and beard, who wears a ridiculous red circus turban, and thinks he's someone important because the American tourists want to have their photo taken with him. If he so much as sees a driver near the hotel, he'll glare. He'll shake a finger like a schoolteacher. That's the driver's fate. Every other servant thinks he can boss over us. There are strict rules at the Five Stars about where the drivers keep their cars while their masters are inside. Sometimes they put you in a parking spot downstairs. Sometimes in the back.